Christ's associations. The Swabian League's vitality inhibited the activation of the Christ structure in that region. The first Swabian Christ Assembly only convened in 1542, 8 years after the League's charter expired. Thereafter, Swabia became the most active and effective of all 10 Kreiser, because its collective institutions repeatedly proved their worth in resolving common problems in this, the most territorially fragmented of the empire's regions. The more inclusive character of Christ's representation made the assemblies especially useful for the empire's weakest territories, which lacked full votes in the Reichstag. Confessional tension periodically disrupted the Swabian Assembly, which met in separate Protestant and Catholic congresses on several occasions during the 17th century. These were always a crisis rather than a break, as the overall Christ structure survived throughout and ensured the two parties still talked to each other. The Kreiser had been assigned a wide range of functions by the imperial legislation between 1500 and 1570, establishing them as legitimate platforms for regional and cross-regional collaboration. Their assemblies convened common congresses between 1544 and 1577, but these were rendered redundant by the Reichstag's supremacy as the national forum. This was something that the electors actively promoted to secure their own political preeminence. However, the Christ assemblies demonstrated their utility during the Thirty Years' War, when they provided confessionally neutral venues for the empire's weaker political elements to coordinate their response to the crisis. Security concerns after 1648 encouraged continued efforts to base regional and cross-regional defense on the Christ structure. This gained momentum as mutual rivalries revealed the fragility of purely princely alliances, which proved unable to outlast the temporary coincidence of interest prompting their formation. The most significant was the Rhenish Alliance of 1658 to 1668, which was the only princely group to have a broader agenda of stabilizing the post-1648 political balance in the empire. Led by Mainz, the alliance eventually encompassed around 20 Protestant and Catholic secular and ecclesiastical princes. Yet it was fatally compromised by its association with France, a power clearly intending its sponsorship of the group as a means to disrupt Habsburg management of the empire. As part of the imperial constitution, the Kreiser offered a framework capable of sustaining broad cross-status alliances through formal associations agreed by two or more Kreis assemblies, which were binding on all their members. The more inclusive representation through the assemblies reassured the weaker estates that they had a reliable mechanism to control their more powerful neighbors. The new responsibilities assigned to the Kreiser by the empire's defense reform in 1681 to 1682 prevented the electors from frustrating such cooperation as they had done in the late 16th century. In fact, Mainz emerged as the main promoter of Christ associations because its electors took their responsibilities towards the empire seriously and saw leadership of the smaller imperial estates as a way of sustaining their traditional status as arch-chancellors. Swabian-Franconian collaboration expanded after 1691 into an association with the Bavarian, Westphalian, Upper and Electoral Rhenish Kreiser, thus encompassing the majority of the empire's weakest territories. The association greatly assisted defense coordination, but suffered from the polarization of imperial politics through Austro-Prussian rivalry. Although renewed indefinitely on the 1st of March 1748, the association's stipulation that its members be allowed to remain neutral rendered it useless for Habsburg policy, and it effectively ceased to exist. Underlying the demise of the Kreiss Association was a much broader factor that rendered all princely and noble leagues redundant. The Reichstag's permanence, after 1663, gave all imperial estates an effective forum to debate policy and assert status. 18th-century princely alliances were primarily expressions of clientele politics, as princes sought to advance their dynastic goals by allying with the Emperor or major international partners like France, Britain, or the Dutch Republic. The pattern only changed in the 1770s, as middling princes discussed how to preserve their autonomy amidst Austro-Prussian tension. However, they no longer saw the cities, counts, prelates, or knights as useful partners, and indeed harbored designs to annex them to make their own lands more viable. This direction assumed its logical conclusion in the ultimate of all princely leagues, the Confederation of the Rhine of 16 middling princes with Napoleon in July 1806, which precipitated the empire's collapse a month later. Cities. The Lombard League. Civic leagues were a response to the threats posed by lords and princes. Like aristocratic associations, they were ultimately rendered redundant by the growth of a variety of imperial institutions that proved a more attractive means to maintain their members' identity and autonomy. Townsfolk were jealous of their freedoms, which they rarely wished to extend to their rural neighbors, whom they frequently derided as bumpkins or as servile followers of lords. The latter were also regarded as part of the rural world, separate from urban sophistication, though this distinction was less pronounced in Italy than in Germany. Lords were resented for their demands for taxes, and, later, soldiers and artillery. The development of effective gunpowder weaponry from the mid-15th century prompted many towns to rebuild their fortifications and to store artillery and ammunition, placing them at the forefront of military developments. Even in the 18th century, imperial cities were expected to provide most of the imperial army's artillery train. For their part, lords saw towns as dangerous havens of equality, responsible for subverting their tenants and encouraging a land flight that denuded them of workers. New ideas of knighthood partly transcended lordly and princely hierarchies from the 13th century to forge a common sense of themselves as noble warriors embodying true freedom, in contrast to grubby towns filled with greedy merchants and wage slaves. However, lords and cities were not necessarily antagonistic. Lords were often involved in founding and promoting urban development and benefited from civic amenities. Townsfolk could see advantages in lordly protection, while the trend to more oligarchical urban government created an upper stratum whose members were often keen to acquire noble status. These ambiguities are manifest in the history of the empire's civic leagues, which was never a simple clash between progressive citizens and reactionary aristocrats. Lordly civic relations were always part of a wider matrix that could see cooperation or conflict depending on circumstances. As we have heard, most towns experienced internal tensions between those holding power and others seeking to supplant them. The situation in Italy was further complicated by the attempts of major cities to control their surrounding regions, and by the papal-imperial conflicts of the High Middle Ages. Many Italian burghers, including the Romans, preferred the emperor to the pope, but, as we have heard, the empire's rulers did not view politics in class terms, and their alliances with individual towns were contingent on circumstances. Frederick I, Barbarossa, demanded that Italian lords and cities return imperial regalia at the assembly in Roncalia in November 1158. However, he was prepared to transfer privileges back to those cities that supported him, like Pavia, Cremona, Como, and Lodi. Local tensions between these cities and their own rivals prompted Milan to establish an alliance with Piacenza, Brescia, and Tortona in 1159, which proved the precursor to Italy's most powerful civic group, the Lombard League, Lega Lombarda. Events fitted the pattern of imperial intervention in Italy since 1077, with the emperor becoming mired in local and regional disputes. Conflict escalated as he had to reward allies, defend his honor, and avenge setbacks. Milan was besieged at the instigation of the Archbishop of Cologne, Reinald of Dassel, whom Barbarossa had appointed as legate in Italy. Once captured in March 1162, Milan was razed, and even its churches were demolished, their holy relics being carried off in triumph to Cologne. With Milan temporarily eliminated, the emperor's civic partners had little reason to continue their collaboration and soon resented his tax demands. In March 1167, Cremona and Pavia formed the Lombard League, which swiftly expanded to include Bergamo, Brescia, Mantua, Padua, Venice, Verona, Vicenza, and Romagnol towns such as Bologna and Ferrara. The organization was backed by Pope Alexander III, who gave his name to the League's new fortress of Alessandria, built in 1168 to block imperial control of the Po Valley. However, the League never encompassed all Lombard cities, as local rivalries drove many into the imperial camp, including Milan, which was rebuilt in 1167. Verona formed its own, generally anti-imperial group to the east, while the Tuscan towns combined on a similar basis to the south. Barbarossa accepted the impossibility of defeating the League by agreeing a six-year truce in 1177, which was extended as the Compromise Peace of Constance in June 1183. The cities accepted continued imperial overlordship in return for confirmation of their communal autonomy and recognition of their league. The good working relationship persisted until the imperial civil war following the double election of 1198. Self-interest trumped corporate solidarity as Milan and its allies backed Otto IV, while Cremona and its associates supported the Stauffers. Milan established a new Lombard League in March 1226, which became a significant factor in the renewed round of imperial-papal conflicts lasting into the 1250s. However, centrifugal forces grew with the rise of the Signori, who saw control of communal government as a means to extend local hegemony. The Stauffer's demise removed the emperor as a factor in North Italian politics for nearly three quarters of a century, during which civic solidarity was further eroded by the continued growth of more despotic governments. German Civic Leagues. Few German cities matched their Italian counterparts' control of their immediate hinterlands, and they were much more dependent on good relations with lords and other neighbors to secure the free flow of food and trade. Meanwhile, the Stauffer's promotion of a more numerous princely elite created a different political environment in which many German towns felt acutely vulnerable. Most towns were clustered in the Rhineland, Wetterau, and Swabia, the areas where lordly jurisdiction was most fragmented and complex. This was both an opportunity and a threat. Fragmented jurisdictions could open possibilities for greater civic autonomy, especially for episcopal towns to escape their bishops' control. However, proximity to multiple lords increased the chances for friction and antagonism. North German towns faced different challenges. Although there were fewer lords in their immediate vicinity, the long-distance trade required by these towns crossed multiple lordly jurisdictions and brought them into contact with powers outside the empire, like Sweden and Russia. The Stauffer's preoccupation with Italy and southwest Germany forced northern towns to find alternative ways to protect their interests. The result was a diverging pattern of civic alliances. The northern towns gradually combined as the Hanseatic League, Hansa, the largest civic alliance anywhere in medieval Europe. Centered on Lübeck, which itself had only been founded 17 years earlier, the Hansa developed after 1160 as a means to protect specific trade routes, such as that between Lübeck and Novgorod. It broadened in the 13th century into a federated network as trade crisscrossed between cities, establishing closer ties, like that between Hamburg and Lübeck after 1241. Writing at a time of heightened global competition with Britain, 19th and early 20th century German historians presented the Hansa as the economic and cultural representatives of their nation, while more recent writers, by contrast, considered the League as offering an alternative to centralized state formation. The Hansa's reach was certainly impressive, for it absorbed the Westphalian and Lower Saxon civic leagues, both formed 1246, as well as the Wendish alliance of South Baltic towns. By 1300, its trade network encompassed 2 million square kilometers and 15 million people, half of whom were outside the empire. The core area extended for 1,500 kilometers of coastline from Flanders to Finland, with links up major rivers to inland cities like Cologne, Goslar, and Magdeburg. The Hansa began using its collective weight after 1277 to force kings and princes to grant favorable trading concessions, leading to a series of struggles after 1388 with England, Russia, and the Count of Flanders. The core group of Wendish cities around Lübeck were foremost in promoting these conflicts, often against the wishes of other members. Meanwhile, individual cities used their new wealth to buy out local lords, who sold their jurisdictions to the city councils. For example, in 1392, Hamburg bought out the Count of Schauenburg, who claimed the old rights over the city once exercised by the Archbishop of Bremen. This enabled Hamburg, Lübeck, and some other cities to become free, like episcopal cities that had escaped their bishop's control. Lübeck was relatively unusual in securing the additional status of an imperial city in 1226, though it did not attend imperial assemblies at this point. The emperor rarely appeared in the north and was not regarded as a natural partner. Although still part of the empire, the Hanseatic towns did not participate in its politics or contribute to imperial reform. However, they did not create much of an alternative either, remaining only a loose alliance until the 1470s, when they belatedly established more formal structures, including an assembly. The extended membership and diverse trading interests made it difficult to find common ground. Few members were prepared to help others engaged in what usually appeared to be distant local disputes. Civic leagues emerged elsewhere in Germany around the same time as the Hansa, but with different characteristics. The initial catalyst was Frederick II's absence in Italy, which saw the formation of the First Rhenish League in 1226 around Mainz, Bingen, Worms, and Speyer, all episcopal towns seeking to widen their autonomy. The royal towns of Frankfurt, Gelnhausen, and Friedberg also joined, giving the organization a compact geographical focus on the Rhine-Main nexus. The emperor's initial response was broadly hostile, and civic leagues were banned by the charter granted to princes in 1231. However, in practice, leagues were still tolerated and even encouraged as ways of securing the public peace through regional cooperation. The Wetterau Urban League was established on this basis in 1232, comprising Wetzlar and the three royal towns from the First Rhenish League. The promulgation of an imperial public peace 3 years later gave such organizations firmer legal footing, while the growing disorder following the appearance of anti-kings in 1246 to 1247 encouraged cooperation for mutual protection. A second Rhenish League was established by Mainz and Worms in February 1254 with a 10-year charter. Within a year, it had been joined by over 100 towns across the Rhineland, Westphalia, and southern, central, and northern Germany, including territorial towns that joined with lordly permission. Ladenburg was even ordered to by the Bishop of Worms. 8 ecclesiastical and 12 secular princes also joined, while William of Holland endorsed the organization in 1255, hoping to bolster his relatively weak royal rule. Richard of Cornwall followed his example after his election in 1257, enhancing the organization's legitimacy and imparting something of the cross-status character displayed later by the Swabian League. Unlike that organization, The Rhenish League remained dominated by the cities and failed to establish a formal infrastructure. Indeed, it exemplified the weaknesses inherent in all the empire's civic leagues, whose rapid initial expansion diluted coherence and undermined unity. Nonetheless, the Rhenish League demonstrated that such organizations could prove potent, at least when faced with common threats. Already in September 1254, it besieged Ingelheim Castle to punish Werner von Bolanden, a knight who had broken the public peace. And in October 1256, it inflicted similar treatment on Count Dieter of Katzenelnbogen. Like the Stauffers, Richard of Cornwall chose his allies according to their respect for established socio-political norms and their support for specific royal policies. And his collaboration with the cities was not an attempt to escape dependency on the princes. Moreover, unlike in Italy, there were 105 royal towns on crown lands by the 1270s, which provided the monarch with more immediate urban partners. Here, Richard acted just like other lords, expecting his towns to back him in return for protection and sanctions for communal freedoms. Subsequently, Rudolf I's reorganization of the crown lands threatened some towns which did not want to exchange their previous direct relationship to the monarch for the supervision of a bailiff appointed from amongst local lords who might have their own more threatening agendas. The rapid succession of kings after 1291 undermined stable royal patronage further, as well as creating a generally more disturbed political environment. The result was a wave of new regional civic alliances, all formally identified with upholding the public peace. Thuringian, 1303, Swabian, 1312, Upper Lusatian, 1346, Alsatian, 1354, Rhenish, 1381, and Lower Saxon, 1382. The greatest of these was the Swabian Civic League, established by Ulm on the 4th of July, 1376. By 1385, some 40 mainly royal towns had joined the League. The Leagues offered a practical way to preserve the peace on which their members' trade and food supplies depended. However, they could lead to problems for the emperor, who was forced to decide between his continued support for their efforts and the backing of strong princes opposed to the cities. Württemberg's defeat of the Swabian towns at Altheim in February 1372 was both a catalyst for the Swabian Civic League and a factor behind Charles IV's reappraisal of his efforts to recover the crown lands. The final break came in 1377 when the royal cities refused to pay homage to Charles's son Wenzel, the newly elected king of the Romans, in protest against the imposition of new taxes and the pawning of four towns to Bavaria. Charles could not ignore such open defiance and began hostilities by devastating the area around Ulm. Despite backing from Bavaria and Württemberg, royal forces were defeated at Reutlingen later in 1377, forcing Charles to promise not to pawn further towns. Relations soon broke down again after Wenzel's accession in 1378, because he continued to insist on the new taxes and failed to restrain the knightly Lions Society, Löwengesellschaft, which had emerged from the former royal bailiwick in the Wetterau and had attacked Frankfurt. In response, the Swabians strengthened their organization by adopting the classic elements of a late medieval union: regular assemblies taking decisions by majority vote and acting as a court. They also mirrored the Elector's Alliance in expressing allegiance to the empire as a transpersonal monarchy whilst opposing Wenzel as king. This was a potentially powerful ideology, since it offered a way to transcend localism and regionalism by linking the welfare of individual communities with that of the empire. The Swabians prefigured the later Kreis associations by forging alliances en bloc with the Rhenish, 1381, and Lower Saxon, 1382, civic leagues, as well as with the Swiss Confederates, 1385. These developments appeared doubly threatening to lords because they occurred during the aftermath of the Black Death, which saw peasants threatening to migrate to towns unless they were granted greater social and economic freedoms. Renewed fighting had already developed after 1381 between individual towns and the weaker minor lords. The unrest was a major factor in the growing resentment of Wenzel's perceived misgovernment of the empire. Wenzel attempted to resolve this by promulgating another public peace at Nuremberg in 1383. The towns objected to the king's insistence that they join this individually rather than collectively, and they forced the princes to recognize the Swabian Civic League as a formal partner in 1384. Two City Wars. As with the Second Rhenish Civic League in the mid-13th century, the potency of the Swabian Civic League attracted some princes, notably the Archbishop of Salzburg. The Archbishop secretly became its ally to protect himself while he pursued his own policy of incorporating rich religious houses like Berchtesgaden Priory, leading to war with the Bavarian Duke in 1387. Emboldened by the recent victory of their Swiss allies over a Habsburg army at Sempach, July 1386, the Swabians felt obliged to back the Archbishop, opening what became the First City War, Städtekrieg, in 1388-1389. This was waged in the typical late medieval manner. None of the belligerents were able to sustain large forces for long, restricting most operations to raids against economic assets, such as sorties by citizens to burn a lord's villages. The townsfolk's willingness to meet the princes in battle proved their undoing. They were defeated by Count Eberhard II of Württemberg at Dürfingen, August 1388, and by Count Palatine Ruprecht II at Worms, November 1388. A new general public peace was proclaimed at Eger in May 1389, obliging the disbandment of the Swabian and Rhenish civic leagues and banning such organizations in future. The episode confirmed what many citizens already knew. Princes were unreliable allies, liable to wreck civic harmony. However, the complexity of local regional imperial interactions inhibited political polarization along status lines. Cities continued to cooperate during Wenzel's last decade and the reign of his successor, Ruprecht, but they refrained from further formal alliances. However, they also joined forces with princes against local common threats. The Swabians even combined with Eberhard II of Württemberg, despite his earlier role as royal tax collector, when they felt threatened by the local knights. Meanwhile, the Wetterau, Swabian, and Alsatian towns joined Mainz and various South German princes in the Marbach League against Ruprecht in September 1405. Open alliances became possible again with the accession in 1410 of Sigismund, who saw civic and knightly associations as substitutes for a territorial base in the empire. However, the emperor still appeared a fairly distant and unreliable partner for towns that faced continued encroachment from powerful princes, like those in the Palatinate, Württemberg, and Ansbach, who were consolidating their jurisdictions more clearly along territorial lines. The 1440s saw the establishment of a new Swabian civic league, along with a separate alliance of Lake Constance towns and a Franconian group led by Nuremberg. The result was another city war in Swabia in 1449-1450, leading to the collapse of the Civic League in that region in 1454, while the Franconians fought slightly more successfully against Margrave Albrecht Achilles of Bayreuth from 1449-1453. The short-term consequence was renewed burgher-noble antagonism. In the medium term, the violence helped propel imperial reform to find a more effective way of resolving conflict. This, in turn, ultimately ended civic emancipation and princely encroachment by stabilizing the identity and jurisdictions of the imperial cities and principalities that were collectively recognized as imperial estates. Integration in imperial institutions. The Second City War already indicated that a balance was emerging between the princes and the royal cities. Albrecht Achilles was unable to breach Nuremberg's impressive new fortified ring, studded with 123 towers. Perhaps more significantly, Bavaria refrained from joining the Margrave, preferring instead more peaceful means to extend its influence by negotiating treaties of protection with several towns. Increasingly, princes realized that their own territorial towns could replace the credit and consumer facilities offered by the imperial cities, making these less attractive targets. The improving agrarian situation eased tensions by discouraging land flight. With a few exceptions like Württemberg, princes abandoned attempts to subdue free and imperial towns in favor of developing those on their own lands, consolidating the empire's diversified urban landscape. Meanwhile, the gathering pace of imperial reform provided royal towns with an alternative to civic leagues. A key factor in Nuremberg's defiance of the Bayreuth Margrave was that its annual revenue was far higher than his. Already in the 1420s, Sigismund and the electors looked to cities as valuable contributors to the common military effort against the Hussites, and continued to do so as the Ottoman menace loomed throughout the century. By 1471, most royal towns sent representatives to each royal assembly, holding their own civic congress, Städtetag, as part of the proceedings. This provided the nucleus of what became the civic corpus as the Reichstag took shape around 1495, by which point the stronger monarchy of the Habsburgs appeared to offer cities a much more reliable partner. By participating in the common institutions, the royal towns now fully became imperial cities, as well as imperial estates. Their imperial status now trumped residual solidarity with other towns, which were now more firmly reduced to mediate elements of princely territories. The process remained in flux between about 1480 and 1555, as the status of individual cities like Trier fluctuated until they clearly accepted or rejected the burdens associated with Reichstag representation. Many city councils had doubts about embracing the new institutions, especially as they felt the official distribution of tax quotas favored the electors and princes. In fact, the assessments were a reasonable reflection of the underdeveloped state of many principalities' finances relative to those of leading cities. The cities were unable to prevent the princes using the Reichstag to force through anti-monopoly legislation in 1512, contrary to the interests of their leading merchants. Religious differences added to the tensions once 60 of the 65 active imperial cities embraced Protestantism after 1524, renewing lordly suspicions of townsfolk as subversives. Although these trends temporarily forged renewed solidarity with the inhabitants of territorial towns, they also opened new rifts amongst the burghers of the imperial cities. The Reformation often split populations along socio-economic lines, with the poor converting in Augsburg, Biberach, Ravensburg, and Dinkelsbühl, while the patricians remained Catholic. The resultant unrest provided Charles V with the excuse to annex Konstanz and rewrite the constitutions of 27 other imperial cities between 1548 and 1552. Article 27 of the 1555 religious peace denied imperial cities the full right of reformation, fixing their confessional character whilst providing some safeguards for dissenting minorities. By 1618, 35 were largely Protestant, while 20 were predominantly Catholic, but virtually all had significant minorities. Sectarianism fused with socio-economic problems to cause public disorder in Augsburg, Aachen, Kaufbeuren, Dinkelsbühl, and, most notoriously, Donauwörth, where Bavarian intervention to restore peace became one of the incidents cited by the Palatinate to justify establishing the Protestant Union. The problems of the late 16th century encouraged an introspective conservatism intended to reduce the risks of further intervention. Meanwhile, the improved effectiveness of the imperial courts during the later 17th and 18th centuries provided cities with more peaceful ways to diffuse their internal problems whilst preserving their autonomy. Continued attachment to the empire was reinforced by the absence of any viable alternative. The Hansa failed to match either the political centralization of their royal trading partners like Denmark and England, or the institutional integration provided by imperial reform. Their loose federation was unable to prevent the stronger members stealing economic opportunities from their weaker neighbors. The Flanders towns transferred with most of Burgundy to the Habsburgs in 1477. Leading North German members like Hamburg, Cologne, and Goslar participated in the new imperial institutions emerging around 1500. Notably, the Kreis structure offered a new way of regulating relations with neighboring princes in northern Germany, while the Reichstag's development also served to integrate this region into the empire. Although 63 Hanseatic towns agreed to federate with the empire in 1557, full integration was delayed by their reluctance to accept the burdens of Turkish defense, which grew significantly during the second half of the 16th century. Meanwhile, Russian and Swedish expansion along the southern Baltic shore both exposed the dangers and reduced the Hansa towns to those in the empire. Several leading towns advocated closer involvement with imperial institutions, especially as Rudolf II's political alignment with Spain served their economic interests, which were suffering from English competition. In 1597, Rudolf banned the English merchant adventurers from trading in the empire. England retaliated by no longer recognizing the Hansa after 1602, causing a split as Hamburg and other cities wanted to continue trading with the merchant adventurers. By 1604, only 14 cities still paid Hanseatic membership dues. The downward spiral reduced collective weight, further encouraging engagement with the empire as an alternative. The Hansa attempted to remain neutral during the Thirty Years' War, but only the heavily fortified cities of Hamburg, Bremen, and Lübeck managed this, thanks also to their importance as financial and diplomatic centers for all sides. The Hansa were confirmed as a legal corporation in 1648, but were now viewed suspiciously by other imperial cities. Growing threats from Denmark and Sweden encouraged Hamburg and Bremen to secure their autonomy by formal recognition as imperial cities after 1654. They were simply too important to fall under the jurisdiction of a foreign power. By contrast, applications from other Hansa towns were all rejected in the 1640s, and these were allowed to slip into the status of territorial towns. Münster, Erfurt, Magdeburg, and Brunswick were all bombarded into submission when they refused. By 1667, the Hansa was essentially defunct. The imperial cities stabilized as 13 Catholic, 34 Protestant, and 4 biconfessional cities, of which 31 were in the old imperial heartland of southwest Germany. The Peace of Westphalia, 1648, consolidated their position as imperial estates, while reform of collective defense and the development of Kreis associations removed any incentive for separate civic leagues. Rather than seeking independence as sovereign republics, imperial cities asserted their corporate status as noble, meaning free and elevated above both their own subjects and other territorial towns. Peasants and the common man. Communalism. The city's rejection of a broader alliance with rural inhabitants was another factor in the integration of the former within the empire's status hierarchy. The construction of a broader socio-political order based on the horizontal associative aspects of communities has been labeled communalism and has been claimed as late medieval Germany's third way to modernity between absolutist territorial state building and the construction of a homogeneous national state. Communalism was a specifically late medieval, early modern form of egalitarianism that was collective in that it focused on the community rather than the individual. Freedom was expressed and celebrated collectively through communal gatherings and festivals, and by verbal and visual reminders of the community's traditions and identity. All this originated in the communal self-government emerging in the empire's towns and villages during the High Middle Ages. It was a movement of ordinary folk seeking a better life amidst often harsh and adverse circumstances, and it emerged pragmatically and well before the rediscovery of classical Greek civic democracy by humanist scholars during the Renaissance. Communalism extended individual communal self-government by using the same practices to federate multiple communities, effectively building state-like organizations from the ground up. As with all aspects of communal development, it is important not to romanticize or exaggerate communalism. As we have heard, communal government contained vertical as well as horizontal elements through its basis in the enfranchisement of largely male householders and its exclusion or marginalization of the poor, unmarried, and recently arrived. Communities might indeed unite in the face of external threats, but these could also divide them. Harmony was often fabricated or achieved through peer pressure and the punishment of deviance. Moreover, the communal ideal of freedom remained one of emancipation rather than empowerment. It was freedom from dependency and threat. Communal freedom was often voiced in antagonistic terms, similar to what later ages would term the rhetoric of class war. Yet it lacked the abstract concepts of liberty and equality used by, for example, the American and French revolutionaries in the late 18th century. Although capable of innovation, communal movements were not seeking to build a brave new society according to a grand blueprint, but instead defended an idealized version of their existing order against perceived threats. Communal forms derived strength from face-to-face interaction within communities. This restricted wider structures to federal forms, since only these allowed each community to preserve its own identity and purpose. The preceding examination of civic leagues has already revealed the free rider problem inhibiting their development into more durable political forms. Cities might be vulnerable, but they were usually better protected, larger and wealthier than villages. Standing alone did not appear as daunting as it might for rural inhabitants. This generally restricted communalism to the areas of non-nucleated settlement, like hamlets and scattered farmsteads. The formation of some overarching governance in such areas was often the only way their inhabitants could combat natural hazards and external threats. Non-nucleated settlement tended to be located in regions where other geographic features also favored communalism rather than lordship. Communalism thrived on the empire's economic and political periphery amongst communities sufficiently wealthy to be viable, but not rich enough to attract raiders or encourage involvement in wider politics. Dithmarschen. One such region was the coastal strip from Flanders to the Danish peninsula. Unlike the areas further east along the Baltic, the North Sea coast was incorporated relatively early into the empire, but remained politically peripheral and underpopulated. It was included in the county and, later, parish structures, but was never a major area of interest to the lay or spiritual elite. A mix of lordly and communal elements emerged, with the former predominating in Flanders in the west, and the latter to the east in Frisia. While towns developed in Flanders, the more northerly and easterly areas saw smaller self-governing communities emerge through lordly absenteeism. Lords were few and more interested in affairs elsewhere. They delegated supervision to stewards and other intermediaries. Over time, these supervisory powers were transferred to locals or lapsed altogether. Local people wanted autonomy, not the absence of all protection or recognition from existing authorities. The empire's multi-layered structure allowed them to achieve their goals through securing imperial sanction for their special status. The region was not unfavorable. The marshy soil proved quite fertile, especially in the area of Dithmarschen north of the Elbe estuary, which supported 40,000 inhabitants by the mid-16th century, or twice the population density of central Switzerland. Dithmarschen had already been made a county in the Carolingian era, but lordly control was always weak, even after the count's rights were transferred to the Archbishop of Bremen in 1180. The inhabitants were only obliged to pay a small fee on the accession of each archbishop. Communal self-government had already emerged by the 11th century, thanks to the need to cooperate to maintain the dikes and other flood defenses. The introduction of a parish structure during the 13th century provided a framework to construct more effective common institutions. Each parish sent representatives to a common assembly, codified in the Charter of 1447, which confirmed a typically communal form of a 48-member council, balanced by a general assembly, representing a federation of around 20 parishes. Already termed Universitas Terrae Dithmarchiae by its inhabitants in 1283, this peasant republic demonstrated its potency by repelling attempts by the Count of Holstein to assert lordly authority in 1319 and 1404. Dithmarschen's influence peaked in the century after consolidating its government in 1447. The emperor treated it as an imperial fief, summoning the peasants to send representatives to royal assemblies in the 1430s, and again to the Reichstag in 1496. However, like the royal towns, the peasants found that the empire's growing status hierarchy made interaction with formal institutions difficult. Moreover, Frederick III wanted to extend his influence into northern Germany and saw the region's lords as more obvious partners who could be integrated more closely within the empire by elevation as imperial princes. To this end, he elevated Holstein's count to a duke and recognized his territorial ambitions by formally enfeefing him with Dithmarschen in 1474. The peasants demonstrated a sophisticated understanding of the complexities of imperial politics by protesting to Pope Sixtus IV that the emperor was undermining the imperial church on the grounds that their county belonged to the Archbishopric of Bremen. Frederick was forced to rescind his enfeefement in 1481. The Danish king had inherited Holstein's claim and now saw an opportunity to advance his territory to the Elbe, which would allow him to tax the lucrative river trade. Employing a ruthless mercenary band, the Black Guard, he invaded, only to be routed at the Battle of Hemmingstedt on the 17th of February 1500 by the peasants, who exploited their local knowledge to pole vault across the marshes and trap the invaders. However, what had been advantageous turned to Dithmarschen's detriment by the mid-16th century. Their relative isolation left them without natural allies, unlike either the Swiss or Dutch. In particular, the absence of any indigenous town deprived them of connections to the empire's urban networks. Neighbors resented them as wreckers and pirates, luring coastal shipping into their treacherous shallows. The Hansa accordingly rejected their application for membership. A renewed Danish invasion triumphed in 1559, though the king was obliged to leave the inhabitants considerable autonomy. Frisia. Frisia, immediately to the west of Dithmarschen, shared similar origins, but exhibited less coherence, despite articulating an identity around Frisian freedom. The region had been conquered by the Franks around the mid-8th century, but was granted its own laws and largely left to look after itself. It was not until the Staufer era that a concerted effort was made to integrate the region more firmly within the empire, a move encouraged by the general migration north and east into previously underpopulated areas. The Staufer's first choice of ruler, the Bishop of Utrecht, was killed by the Frisians in battle in 1227. The region was then assigned to Holland, whose Count William became one of the contenders for the German crown after 1247. His attempt and his reign ended when his horse crashed through the ice and he was captured and killed by the Frisians in January 1256. His successor as Count managed to conquer West Frisia by 1289. Control remained difficult into the 14th century, and West Frisia passed along with Holland to Burgundy in 1433. Frisia's fragmentation was part of the gradual process of demarcating clearer territorial jurisdictions across the late medieval empire. Regions without lords either had to find their own place in the hierarchy or risked incorporation within another territory. Frisia's eastern edge became the County of Oldenburg, whose ruler benefited from kinship with the Danish king after the mid-15th century. While Oldenburg evolved as a conventional lordship, several other communities were settled by colonists between the Lower Weser and the mouth of the Elbe, and they, like Dithmarschen's peasants, were able to secure greater self-governance under the loose superior jurisdiction of Bremen's archbishop. The community of Stedingen was the most westerly, sited on the Weser north of Bremen, and inhabited by around 12,000 to 15,000 people who were personally free but under the archbishop's suzerainty. The need to cooperate to maintain flood defenses forged this community around 1200. But its attempt to escape the archbishop entirely foundered after 1207, as he was not prepared to grant the same freedoms as those secured in Dithmarschen. Lordly control was asserted using a crusade after 1232, the same method then being employed further east along the Baltic shore. Stedingen's inhabitants were defeated in 1234, and their community was divided by Oldenburg and the Archbishopric of Bremen. The fate of the remaining four communities was mixed. Rustingen was physically split asunder by an inundation in 1314, with half subsequently absorbed into Oldenburg, while the western part became the lordship of Jever. Würsten on the marshes north of Bremerhaven fell under the archbishop's control during the 1520s. Kadingen was a 47-kilometer-long marsh across the lower Elbe, which passed to Bremen along with the rest of the county of Stade in 1236. Four campaigns finally forced its inhabitants to accept the bishop's rule, though he allowed them to retain considerable autonomy. Along with the other marsh communities, Kadingen became the fourth peasant estate in Bremen's territorial assembly in 1397. Although excluded from representation during the 1590s, the peasants continued to claim rights to participate. Hadeln differed from the other communities in that it had been settled much earlier and was part of Saxony. Like the others, it asserted greater autonomy during the 13th century, but more successfully because the old Saxon duchy fragmented. Hadeln was a 300-square-kilometer self-governing peasant republic with its own law and assembly by the 15th century, and it preserved this directly under the emperor after 1689. Charles VI ceded Hadeln in 1731 to Hanover in return for Hanoverian recognition of the Pragmatic Sanction, changing Habsburg inheritance law. Only East Frisia retained communal government into the 18th century. As with other peasant communities, there was a tendency for village leaders to emerge as hereditary chiefs and gradually acquire the status of lesser nobility from the 13th century. Although they feuded amongst themselves, the Frisian chiefs accepted the Brock family as preeminent from the mid-14th century until 1464, when they were succeeded by the Cirksena, who ruled until 1744. The Cirksena had likewise risen from village leaders, but benefited from Frederick III's policy of integrating the northern periphery by granting titles to local notables. The Cirksena were made imperial counts, 1464, and later princes, 1654. But the bulk of the population remained free householders enfranchised through possession of qualifying farmsteads. Householders dominated the East Frisian estates, which also included the port of Emden, the small towns of Aurich and Norden, and a handful of knights who, unlike those elsewhere, were independent landowners rather than the count's feudatories. The estates bargained for constitutional guarantees in 1595 and 1611. Mirroring Frederick III's policy, Rudolf II endorsed these treaties to tie East Frisia's own constitution to that of the empire, and so stopped it slipping under Dutch influence. The Saxena periodically tried to expand their influence by espousing the cause of the villagers who were disenfranchised by lacking qualifying property. Confessional differences added to political tensions as Emden embraced Calvinism, while the rest of the population adhered to Lutheranism. Problems grew after 1665 as the Saxena adopted a different lifestyle and political behavior in an attempt to join other imperial princes as social equals. Imperial intervention barely held the balance between the competing interests, including renewed external interference from the Dutch, Danes, and neighboring Welf dukes, and the Bishop of Munster. Brandenburg Prussia exploited these difficulties to establish a permanent military presence in Emden after 1682. Tension spilled over into civil war between 1725 and 1727, splitting the estates before the radical Emden faction was defeated and the previous status quo restored. Prussia accepted this situation when it annexed East Frisia in 1744, following an inheritance pact with the last Saxena. The friction seriously impaired functioning governance, rendering the estates incapable of effective action, and thereby essentially disempowering the communes, which had lost their main forum for action.